Yo, what is a cypher?
Putting on that brand new pair of Adidas or Pumas, or taking your Converse and, you know, lacing them up with some fat laces and stuff.
You.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 118, a talk with photographer Joe Conzo. Joe Conzo Jr. has been called the man who took hip-hop's baby pictures by the New York Times, a title that's right on the money. Conzo, a third-generation Bronx native, first got into photography as a young boy and took to shooting pictures of his neighborhood and of events and rallies put on by his aunt, Dr. Evelina Antonetti, the founder of the powerful community organization United Bronx Parents. But it was when he followed some high school friends who had formed a rap group to an early concert that he really found his calling. That group, the Cold Crush Brothers, was perhaps the most influential of hip-hop's first generation. Joe was there to document their every step, from high school gymnasiums to giant clubs and movie sets. His pictures provide the best visual record of hip-hop's early years, before the platinum records and music videos. As if that wasn't enough, Joe's father was a confidant and sometimes manager of Latin music legend Tito Puente, so Joe also had a front row seat to the Latin music explosion of the 1970s and took photos all the while. Personal troubles, discussed in this interview, caused Joe to put away his camera for many years. But over the past decade, his work has been rediscovered and used for documentaries, exhibited in museums all over the world, including the Museum of the City of New York, where an exhibit of his photos is running until September 15th, and even published in a book, Born in the Bronx, A Visual Record of the Early Days of Hip Hop. A fictional version of Joe appears in Baz Luhrmann's upcoming Netflix series, The Get Down, about the early days of hip-hop, where the real Joe was on set as a behind-the-scenes photographer. We began our conversation by discussing a recent appearance Joe made on the NPR series, A Latino History of Hip-Hop. If you enjoy The Cypher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you'll want to check out episode 109, where we talk to another legendary hip-hop photographer who took up right where Joe left off, Jeanette Beckman. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play and a bunch of Joe's pictures, at thecyphershow.com. And now, here's the only firefighter union leader to ever be down with a cold crush, Joe Conzo.
It's a two-part series, and it's the Latino contribution to hip-hop. The way I say it is, like, we've been there since day one.
Right.
I mean, not too many people know that Tito Puente played on Sugar Hill Gang's first album. Special guest by Tito Puente.
You know, I actually didn't even know that until I heard you say that in other interviews. Well,
you know,
researching
Charlie
for this.
Chase, you know, Whipper Whip, all these, you know, crazy legs. But, you know, we've been there since day one. And, you know, what's so ideal about the culture is that it's so mixed and diverse. You know, African Americans are in the forefront. But the Latino contribution's been there since day one. So it's a pretty great interview if you get a chance to listen to it.
Well, I think that was one of the things, you know, obviously they were your friends, but I think one of the things maybe that drew you to the Cold Crush Brothers was the fact that the DJ was Puerto Rican.
True. And that blew me away. But initially is that I went to school with Eazy-AD and Tony Tone
right.
from the Cold Crush Brothers. You know, I was the high school photographer at South Bronx High School. And AD was a star basketball player. And I just got invited one night to shoot this group that they were putting together. I was a disco head. I mean, I had an afro that can compete against, you know, Angela Davis any day. You know what I mean? And I'm like, sure, I'll go. And I was into disco, and I met the guys up in at the T Connection up in Gun Hill Road in White Plains. And the way I tell the story is just that I was just kidnapped to see a Puerto Rican DJ, or any DJ at that point, just play music that my moms and pops played, but played differently.
Right.
It was just so fucking mind-blowing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing about those shows is, like, unless you were there like you or you've heard the tapes, it's hard, I think, to get an idea of what those shows were like, because it's not like they were playing songs exactly, right? It was kind of like routines. Like, if you listen to the early hip-hop records, they're mostly, you know, the songs were 9-10 minutes long, and it's because they were kind of doing what they were doing.
True. I mean, you know, a basic, you know, early jam, because it wasn't called hip-hop, you know, jam yet. A basic early jam was, you know, the DJ playing music. He'd play some songs in their entirety, you know, whatever was good at that time or whatever they found in the crate that day and stuff. And then the fellas, even the women, would come on and do their routine. And then, you know, these routines were, you know, played to Cat Stevens, you know, break beats. You know what I mean? And I'm like, Cat Stevens? You know, Gilbert O'Sullivan?
I'm climbing to the top, will throw myself off in an effort to make clear to who ever what it's like when you're shattered, left standing. And you know, we can't be changed when you prove that we can make you move. Around the bit of you to eat, but we keep rocking on and make it all new songs.
You know, this is what I grew up on, because I grew up to WABC radio, Cousin Brucey, playing the hits.
Yeah.
We all did. I don't think there was FM radio at the time or whatever, or nothing, you know, that powerful. And, you know, I tell people that this, for me, the only genre of music that pretty much borrows from every other genre of music. You know what I mean? So that was your basic night at a jam, so to speak. You know, and then the routines got more important, this, that, and the other, and, you know, and it was just phenomenal.
The outfits got more elaborate, as more you can elaborate, see in your pictures.
You know, they went through their phases, through their cowboy, you know, Western phases with the laces and the tight leather pants. I call that the Rick James phrase.
Yeah, the shirtless with leather vest phase is a particularly memorable
one. Phase,
yeah.
You know what I mean? But
would they discuss that? Would they be like, hey, this is how we're, like, what kind of conversations would they have around fashion?
It gradually built. I mean, you know, in the beginning, it was just, you know, that brand new pair of Lee jeans, you know, starched with a half a can of, you know, starch and shit, you know, and then, you know, that crease became a sewn-in crease that we used to do. You know, bell bottoms, obvious. You know, cleaning your sneakers. And if you were well off and had a summer job or a part-time job, you know, putting on that brand new pair of Adidas or Pumas, or taking your Converse and, you know, lacing them up with some fat laces and stuff.
But as far as the group goes, you know, they usually would coordinate to some degree.
Yeah,
what they
eventually
were wearing.
It got into coordination of wearing, you know, different outfits and, you know, the leather pants and leather tops and, you know, it just grew and it just got a little crazy at one time. It's just like, I just couldn't get into, you know, that punk rock scene. You know, I did own a pair of leather pants one time with some what we call webo boots, you know, leather boots and stuff, but I was a strictly Lee jeans, Adidas, you know, Le Tigre t-shirt or something like that.
Right. And the thing about Cold Crush, you know, other than musically, that set them apart was that they had you, right, taking pictures as their official photographer. They had Tape Master.
recording all the jams. Yeah. I mean, they, you know, I look back at it in hindsight 35 years ago.
For the uninitiated, the Cold Crush Brothers are an influential hip-hop group that formed in the late 1970s in the Bronx. The membership has varied a bit over the years, but the core members during the period discussed in this interview are EZAD, Grandmaster Caz, Tony Tone, Charlie Chase, Whipper Whip, and KG. While the group had some successful singles like 1983's Punk Rock Rap and 1984's Fresh Wild Fly and Bold, their reputation really stems from their dynamic live performances, many of which were caught on tape and on film by Konzo, and can still be heard today. Elvis Tape Master Moreno would make soundboard recordings of many of the Cold Crush's early performances, which the group would then sell. They also worked with Lemoyne Thompson, better known as Buddy Esquire, who created some of the most iconic flyers of the period and was known by many as the King of Flyers. They had several key scenes in the classic 1982 movie Wild Style. Caz also famously wrote Big Bang Hank's verse on Rapper's Delight, though he never received any credit or money for it. Cold Crush, like many of their fellow pioneers, never saw the financial success they deserved, leading some current-day artists to try to make up for that.
It's just like, here's a group of guys, teenager guys, who had the foresight, A, to have a photographer document, you know, not only a friend of theirs, but document most of their shows, have another childhood friend, Tape Master, who would record all the shows on tape. You could buy them the following week at the next show or at the next flea market you ran into. And somebody like Buddy Esquire doing the flyers for them.
Sometimes in collaboration with you.
In collaboration with me, using my photos on the flyers. That was their whole PR, marketing, this, that, and the other. No internet, no radio play, no this, no that. And it's like, you would go to you'd go to school that morning, you know, sneak into the mimeograph room, you know, take one of Buddy's flyers and just mimeograph 1,000 of them, you know.
Yeah.
Hand them out to the foot soldiers of the crew, so to speak, in all five boroughs. And that's how you would announce your next jam for the following week.
Yeah. Were you thinking at all during this period about posterity? I asked this because Caz once said something about you. He said, if it wasn't for this dude, the world wouldn't know what Cold Crush looked like.
I had no idea what I was doing, what I was documenting at the time. I got to be totally, totally honest. I wasn't looking like, yeah, my stuff is going to be deposited in Cornell University 40 years from now. I'm going to be traveling the world to Bulgaria, Germany, London, doing shows. I had no idea. I enjoyed taking pictures with my friends. You know, after the jam that night, I'd go home, you know, the next day, buy what we call a tray bag of marijuana, go into my dark room, print up some pictures for next week's show, and we would throw them out to the crowd.
Right. You had these, you would make 8x10s that you would throw on the crowd.
And no other group was doing it. No other group was doing it. No other group had their own photographer. No other group were using their smoke machine on stage. No other group were you know, had their every set recorded for the following week. So it was just phenomenal. And again, I had no idea.
And you guys were playing to some huge crowds. I think it's a Born of the Bronx book. There's a print of from a show that, judging from the basketball hoops, is in some kind of high school gymnasium.
You got to understand something. You know, a lot of these jams,
4,000 people.
Yeah, a lot of these jams were in high school gymnasiums, local PAL community centers, local church rectories. You know, and it just like gradually went downtown. But you know, some of these places held 1,000 people. You know, and at $1 or $2 to gain entrance.
Yeah.
It was, you know, packed. I mean, if you look at some of my photos, people are sitting up on the basketball hoops and up in the rafters just to see the shows.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about the transition from those kind of all ages things to the nightclubs? I know that was, at first, nightclubs didn't want to bring you guys in because your audience was, you know, high school. It was 14, 15,
high school,
16
yeah. It was a gradual transition, you know, as word spread, you know, Rapper's Delight getting airplay on the radio and stuff. It slowly went downtown. Promoters started seeing it. Negril's Nightclub is a club that sticks out because Michael Hallman and Cool Lady Blue used to run it at the time.
Yeah, Michael's been a guest on the show.
From Cypher episode 45. Here's Michael Holman.
Arguably, it was the first time all the elements of hip-hop were put together on stage in front of a paying audience. Ruza Blue saw the show, asked me to bring it to the Grill. I brought that whole show intact before even my TV, even my film, and had it set up at the Grill, and it was performing there, and it was like the first hip-hop, when you talk about hip-hop in terms of all as a multifaceted culture, it was the first hip-hop nightclub.
And I love Michael. Yeah. He doesn't get enough props, but he is like one of the founding, you know, pioneers or foundation of this culture, because he had the foresight to, A, do Graffiti Rock, the TV show, and promote a lot of the hip-hop acts downtown.
So, what was that like for you kind of going downtown to a place weird. Like the Grill?
Yeah, it was weird because, you know, the audience was Caucasian now.
Right. And if you see your early pictures, it's all black with a smattering of yeah. Latin folks.
Yeah. So now this is a whole different audience. Now, you know, it migrated from uptown in the Bronx down to lower Manhattan to clubs like Negril's, Danceteria, and Roseland Ballroom. I have a shot, you know, where you see this huge cypher. And Roseland Ballroom holds, what, 4,000, 3,000 people? And the Cold Crush Brothers played there, you know, Run DMC, you know, before they were even huge. You know what I mean? And, you know, other places we used to go to were skating rinks. There must have been, you know, 24 skating rinks throughout the 5 boroughs in the tri-state at that time. And we do, you know, talking to Curtis Blow last night, you know, we do these skating rinks, you know, the Roxy. The Roxy was a skating rink. And it turned into a nightclub.
At one of those nightclubs, there was a very, you took a picture of the Cold Crush in a very famous battle with the Fantastic Romantic Five.
Okay.
Of them dressed in gangsters, as gangsters, basically with these sort of toys.
That was at Harlem
guns.
World.
That was at Harlem World.
Harlem World was a club venue for R&B acts.
Mm-hmm.
Sylvia Robinson used to book a lot of acts there. And, they, Cold Crush got into there because of the Treacherous Three. Treacherous Three was a Harlem-based hip-hop group, you know, and they had such an alliance together, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they would go on boat parties together, something I'll ask you about.
Exactly, you know, and, you know, Harlem World was another place that held at least 1,000 people, 1,500 people. And so these big shows went on there, and one of the most famous show that I shot was the battle between the Cold Crush Brothers and the Fantastic Romantic Five with DJ Grand Wizard Theodore. And costumes were in play, smoke machines were in play, you know, as we call it, ringers were put out into the crowd, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, their own fan base people were put out in the crowd wearing, you know, sweatshirts, Cold Crush Brothers, this, that, and the other. And to this day, 30-something years later, you know, it's still a great debate who won the battle then.
Right. I mean, the thing that about that is, like, I've seen accounts saying that, you know, the Fantastic Romantic Five won, but it was kind of like because they had some of their friends scream very loud
right.
up front. And, like, it seems like maybe they won the battle but lost the war.
Yes.
In the sense that, like, the look the Cold Crush used that
yes.
night is like, that you shot
yes.
has become so iconic.
Yes, yes. And it's like, I mean, to this day, you know, here we are talking 35, almost 40 years later. You know, the Cold Crush Brothers are still talked about. If you watched the last episode of Empire, you had the main character, Lucius, you know, quote Jay-Z's song, "I'm going to charge you double for what you did to the Cold Crush Brothers."
I mean, that's the whole reason I'm taking Empire public, is so that my artists can share in the wealth. This is the age of social justice. Like my man Jay-Z said, we're going to make them pay for what they did to Cold Crush back in the day.
I'm overcharging niggas for what they did to the Cold Crush. Pay us like you owe us for all the years that you hold us. We can talk, but money talk, so talk more bucks.
You know, that just blew people away, you know?
Yeah.
Here's a movie shoot going on called The Get Down, and, you know, based on my images and the Cold Crush Brothers performances and stuff like that.
Yeah. So Your childhood in the South Bronx, I've read you describe it. When you describe it, you use words like animated, colorful, happy-go-lucky.
You got to understand something. I'm talking, you know, 60s and 70s. You know, devastation all around going on just a basic level throughout the Bronx at the time. Abandoned buildings, fires, drugs, gangs, this and the other. But it was a different atmosphere because there was more of a family unity, more of a community-based unity. You know, if your upstairs neighbor didn't have food that night, they know they could come downstairs and eat, or vice versa, this, that, and the other. And it was colorful and animated where you can go to each corner, walk down, you know, any block, see people playing congas out in the street, playing music, playing dice, playing this, that, and the other. And it was just, you know, people ask me all the time when I travel the world, how was it growing up in the South Bronx? And I look at them, it's like, fine.
Right, kind of, how was your childhood?
How was your
right?
childhood?
Yeah.
My playground was just, you know, the local abandoned building and, you know, the abandoned cars. But, you know, we made the best of it.
Right. I mean, that's the thing is, like, that era has in a lot of ways been portrayed very one-dimensionally. And so to have someone come in and say, well, I was a kid. I had a great time as a kid.
You can't. What I tell people is, like, you can't miss something if you never had it. So I didn't miss the house with the white picket fence and the swing in the backyard because I didn't have that. You know what I mean? There was a period in time where
You moved out around like 74, right?
My mother's second marriage, she remarried and we lived right up the block on, you know, Amsterdam and Broadway, 121st Street. I went to parochial school. I went to Columbia University. I did kindergarten up to the third grade at Agnes Russell School, private school, you know. Columbia University was my playground, you know, running up and down all through the college and stuff. And I was reminiscing while driving up here. But, you know, and we lived in Chevy Chase, Maryland, you know, with the house and the backyard, this and the other. But that was just a brief period of time, you know. But my basic upbringing was the South Bronx. And I think I turned out well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I had my little, you know, lost periods in my life that everybody goes through. You know, I put the camera down for a minute, you know, dealt with personal issues of drug abuse and this, that, and the other. But I think I turned out pretty well.
Yeah. And your family is so deeply rooted in New York. I know on your dad's side, it goes back to like the late 30s.
Oh, my dad, Joe Conzo Sr., he's known as the foremost historian on Latin music. He was Tito Puente's personal confidant,
right?
And public relation manager, you name it. For over 40 years, he just did a book, Mambo de Diablo, 40 years with Tito Puente there. On my mother's side, you know, my grandmother, Dr. Evelyn Antonetti.
Okay, I was going to ask about her.
Was known as the Hell Lady of the Bronx. You know what I mean? She'd curse out Congress, you know, in a minute, fighting for the basic human rights of the people of the Bronx. My mother just, you know, took over her. That legacy when my grandmother passed away. And just last week, there was a groundbreaking ceremony for my mother. They named a new building that's being built, the Lorraine Montenegro Women and Children's Safe Haven Center.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. So, you know, I come from a long history of, you know, community activism and family and, you know, music business. And I'm happy that I've contributed and continue that legacy through my photography.
Mm-hmm. And your grandmother, Dr. Antonetti, was, I think, the founder or co-founder of United Bronx Parents.
Founder of United Bronx Parents.
Yeah.
And United Bronx Parents started out as a PTA, Parents Teachers Association, in the late 50s or 60s. You know, it just turned into basic human rights and needs at that time. You know, my grandmother is very instrumental, if not part of, that push to have bilingual education in the public schools. You know, when there was a huge migration of Hispanic people into New York during the 40s and 50s, they go to public schools and they couldn't learn because nobody spoke Spanish.
Right.
Nobody spoke Spanish. So my grandmother's like, wait a minute, you know, population is growing. Let's get some, you know, bilingual education into the public school system. So she was instrumental in starting that. And you can see how it's grown up until today. She was instrumental in the summer lunch programs back in the 70s, feeding the kids, because most of the kids back then, a basic meal for the kids was at school. Let's be frank. You know what I mean? And when school was out, you know, that's a meal that they miss. So she started the summer lunch program that fed all five boroughs for many years, the breakfast program. And she was just a champion of basic necessities. And when she passed away in 84, 85, my mother took over the agency, and my mother's trials and tribulations with me and my drug abuse, she opened up a drug treatment center for women with children, the first in the nation.
Wow.
Because if a woman with children wanted to go get help and go into a drug rehab, the kids would go into foster care and get. Sure. How is a woman supposed to get?
Not very good incentive for treatment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So she opened up a program called La Casita before Mother Hale, before all these. And if a woman wanted treatment for drug abuse, they came in, and they came in with their kids.
It's your grandmother, actually. We had Benji Melendez
On
the show not long ago.
Yeah.
Yellow Benji. And, you know,
My big brother.
Yeah. He mentioned, you know, that she was actually, you know, working even with a lot of the youth in the Bronx.
His first job was working United Bronx Parents. And the way the story goes is, like, you know, Benji was part of the Ghetto Brothers at the time. And that's when the peacemaking was coming along and stuff. And the way Benji tells me the story, tells the family story, is that she grabbed him by his ear one day and says, "You want a job? You want to continue doing what you're doing, but you don't want a job?" And he's like, "Yes." And she said, "Go upstairs and take a shower and come work for me." And Benji credits my grandmother for giving him one of his first jobs, access to refrigerated trucks to deliver, you know, breakfast and lunches to the kids. And that's where I met Benji. And Benji worked for United Bronx Parents for many, many, many years as a counselor, as a karate instructor and stuff. I described Benji back then as the Pipe Piper, because he just had all these kids following him every day.
Yeah.
And I just gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award 2 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
Because I just love him.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, another person who sort of, like you, kind of crossed over between the political and the music scene, and who you took some fantastic portraits of. I will probably butcher his last name, but Joseph...
Empa.
Okay.
Joseph Empa. Joseph Joe, as we affectionately know, worked for my grandmother also, but also came from a background of gangs and stuff. I think he was part of the Black Panthers at one time.
Mm-hmm.
But he was instrumental in, you know, speaking with Benji and doing that whole peace treaty. But, you know, he worked at United Bronx Parents also. And he had many different positions there and, you know, was a personal confidant of my grandmother at the time. And to this day, he's a great family friend and still doing great community service work out in the Bronx. Mm-hmm.
And your father, you mentioned, obviously wrote, you know, was Tito Puente's confidant, sometimes manager, has, you know, taken preserving Tito's legacy to heart,
yes.
You know, writing a book and doing stuff after Tito's passing.
Right.
Now, at the time you were growing up, there was kind of a resurgence of interest in Latin music, specifically in New York with the Fania label and all that kind of stuff.
Fania Records was a New York-based record label founded by Dominican-born composer and bandleader Johnny Pacheco and Italian-American lawyer Jerry Masucci in 1964. Fania is known for its promotion of what has become known as salsa music. The label started out as a small venture, but gained popularity after the success of the first official record, Pacheco's Cañonazo, leading to the expansion of its talent base. Among Fania's signature stars are Willie Colon, Celia Cruz, Larry Harlow, Ray Barreto, Ralphie Pagan, Luis Perico Ortiz, Bobby Valentin, Ruben Blades, Hector Lavoy, Cheo Feliciano, and many others. In 1968, Pacheco created a supergroup known as the Fania All-Stars that brought together the elite of salsa musicians and singers for joint performances and recording. The Fania All-Stars were Fania's best-selling band, outlasting the label itself. They made their debut at the Red Garter Club located in New York's Greenwich Village, but it was their 1971 performance at the Cheetah, a club in Midtown Manhattan, which became legendary.
Right.
And a lot of those people were your aunts and uncles.
So this is how my day went, okay? This is a typical Joey Kane at the time.
Joey Kane,
at the time, because my mother had remarried, and Michael Kane, who I credit to get me into photography, because he was an avid amateur photographer at the time. He adopted my brother and I to have his last name. So for up until I was about 22, 23 years old, I was known as Joey Kane.
Yeah.
So people were like,
huh? We got Joey Kane in the house.
There you go. AKA Joe Conzo. But, you know, my typical day was if I wasn't hanging out with my high school buddies or my you know, friends from the block doing hip hop pictures, mm-hmm. I'd be hanging out with my dad shooting Tito Puente, Celia Cruz, Larry Harlow, the Palmieri brothers. I mean, you name it, because my dad traveled with Tito everywhere.
Ernesto Antonio Tito Puente was an American mambo musician and Latin jazz composer. Raised in Spanish Harlem, Puente is often credited as the musical pope, El Rey de los Timbales, and the king of Latin music. He is best known for dance-oriented mambo and Latin jazz compositions that endured over a 50-year career. During the 1950s, Puente was at the height of his popularity and helped to bring Afro-Cuban and Caribbean sounds like mambo, son, and cha-cha-cha to mainstream audiences. Puente was so successful playing popular Afro-Cuban rhythms that many people mistakenly identify him as Cuban. Later, he moved into more diverse sounds, including pop music, bossa nova, and others, eventually settling down with a fusion of Afro-Cuban and Latin jazz genres that became known as salsa, a term he actually disliked. In 1979, Puente won the first of five Grammy Awards for the albums, A Tribute to Benny Moré, On Broadway, Mambo Diablo, and Goza Mi Timbal. He even has a street and post office in East Harlem named after him. He's guest starred on several television shows, including Sesame Street, The Cosby Show, and even The Simpsons two-part episode, Who Shot Mr. Burns?
You know, Tito was like, is considered, you know, I used to call him Tio. Tio is Spanish for uncle. And through my father's relationship with Tito, I have all these iconic shots of the Latin music during its peak. You know, when it, you know, that resurgence you speak of, 70s and 80s, when La Fania came around and this, that, and the other. So.
Yeah. What was he like? To the extent you saw him around you and your father, like Tito, well, you know.
Again, Tito Puente could, it's just amazing that he was such a huge, and I say that again, huge star. He was just an ordinary person. No bodyguards, no nothing. Would walk down the street, sign autographs, kiss babies, this, that, and the other. You know, pose for pictures. You know, unlike these Latin stars today where you can't get 100 feet next to them because they have 10 bodyguards and this, that, and the other. And I'm not going to mention names like Mark Anthony or Jennifer Lopez or anything like that, but,
right.
You know, but that's how Tito was.
Right.
And that's how most of them were. I mean, Eddie Palmieri, you know, walk up to him, you know, Johnny Pacheco. These were huge, huge stars. Doing free concerts in the street, you know, doing, you know, they did a gig for my grandmother at United Bronx Parents. And it's well documented on this BBC documentary called Salsa or something like that. And you see in the background, Tito playing, you see the United Bronx Parents banner in the background. It would, all it was a phone call. So, you know, how was Tito? Tito was my uncle.
Yeah.
So to speak, my second father.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was just huge. And these guys would travel the world, but would have no problem coming back to the Bronx. Give him a stage. Don't give him a stage. You know, Machito, you know, just phenomenal.
Yeah. And the United Bronx Parents you brought up, I was looking through your pictures, and you have so many pictures of their picnics. The United Bronx Parents annual picnics.
I mean, again, I was that chubby little kid with an Angela Davis afro walking around with a camera because I love to document my scenery, my friends, my family, this, that, and the other, not knowing what I was documenting at the time. And I just love photography so much that, you know, junior high school photographer, high school photographer, you know, I took a year off, worked for a fine arts photographer down on the West Side. From there, I enrolled in School of Visual Arts, SVA, did a year and a half, had to drop out, couldn't afford the tuition, and that's how I got into the medical field. But photography was my passion and my love. If you can find on the internet my high school photograph and the yearbook, and I pretty much said, you know, under my picture was, I wanted to become that world-famous photographer, travel the world, worked for Playboy, UPI, API, and this, that, and the other. It took 30 years, but I've accomplished
that. But it happened, yeah.
It happened.
And, you know, one part of your photography that doesn't really get a ton of notice is, you know, I mentioned your portrait earlier. It's like you have a ton of portraits, mostly of girls.
Yes.
Which
well,
I imagine.
Again, I tell the story. I was a chubby little kid with an Angela Davis afro, wasn't that very athletic, couldn't DJ, couldn't MC, didn't really have the gift of gab, but I was one of the few kids that walked around with a camera.
Yeah.
And young girls at the time would love to have their pictures taken.
Yeah.
Because I'd go to my darkroom, develop the pictures, and give them the pictures the next day.
Other than, you know, being an excuse to hang out with pretty girls, what was it about portraiture that, like, appealed to you?
I can find beauty in so many things. I mean, to me, black and white is more colorful than color pictures. The kids that I grew up with, my neighbors, my friends, my hangout buddies, this, that, and the other, were, you know, just so amazing to me. You know, good times. And, you know, some of the girls growing up, beautiful girls at the time, you know. So I did a lot of portraitures. I experimented with medium format cameras, you know, 2.25 cameras, this, that, and the other, because I technically wanted to be that good photographer. A, because I was going to school at the time, so I knew who Ansel Adams was, the famous. So, you know, I believe in if you love something so much, you know the roots of it, and you know the technical aspects of it, and this, that, and the other. So I dabbled in portrait photography. I dabbled in fine arts photography, shooting, you know, working part-time for a photographer downtown, going to MoMA, shooting.
Some of your statue studies.
Yes, statue studies and shooting, you know, paintings, $300,000 paintings and stuff, you know. So I was fortunate enough to have some schooling and some background. But, you know, the majority of my work is just OJT, on-the-job training, just shooting.
You know, some of the stuff you took of the Bronx is just amazing. I feel like there's a couple pictures. I was a little confused by this. Maybe you can clear it up. It looks like they were taken almost like in the aftermath of a flood or something. Like
I know what picture you're talking about, or a series of pictures. That was probably after a hydrant was opened up in this, that, and the other. You know
water.
What I mean?
Yeah.
Again, vacant lots, our playground. Open up a hydrant, play. If you were fortunate enough to have a skateboard, you skateboard through the water and this, that, and the other. It's funny how a lot of my Bronx images are of firemen and firefighters, you know.
Given
fires.
What you would come to do.
And, you know, fast forward, I ended up working for the fire department.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's just like I dabbled into landscape. You know, I have a lot of shots that I shot from rooftops and just, you know, shot the skylines of, you know, the old Yankee Stadium and the Grand Concourse and this, that, and the other. So I even dabbled in nude photography, believe it or not. I mean, natural lighting, nude photography and stuff. And it's just like, I just did a little bit of everything because I love photography so much.
Yeah. You know, getting back to kind of the political part of your life, growing up around your grandmother and seeing her political life, her interactions with the community, how did that shape your sense of community, of belonging to a community, of like what that is, what the responsibilities of that are.
It is instilled in me and in my brothers and sisters and the rest of the family a sense of responsibility for our community where we live. You know what I mean? To quote my grandmother, you know, she gave her life for the people of the Bronx. And, you know, there's a saying that I don't know off the top of my head, but pretty much goes like when she's gone, she has strong children and grandchildren that would carry on that responsibility of fighting for the basic needs and necessities of the people of the Bronx. So, again, it gave me that that sense of pride, a sense of unity, that family unity, you know, not only from my Puerto Rican culture, but for where I lived at also, the Bronx. And, you know, my book, Born in the Bronx.
Born in the Bronx, of course, yeah.
Tattooed on my arm.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It just, to this day, the Bronx still gets a bad rap, but they don't know. And when I say they, I just people in general, you know, so much has come out of the Bronx. The Bronx is noted. We're the only borough attached to the mainland. How fucking cool is that? You know what I mean? Home of Yankee Stadium, Botanical Garden, the Bronx Zoo, this, that, and the other. Al Pacino grew up in the Bronx. You know what I mean? So there's so much that it has to offer. And it's a shame that we're always referred to, you know, the burnt out Bronx, the crime and the drugs and this, that, and the other. But my grandmother instilled that sense of protecting ours and making it better.
And, you know, there's an overlap there with your father in the sense that, like, I saw an interview with him about his book, and he was saying almost verbatim something you always say, which is about the importance of documenting the culture from inside.
You know, it's funny you bring that up because I've always felt that if I don't document my history, somebody else is going to do it. And 9 times out of 10, it's going to be an outsider. There's a big brouhaha going on right now with a photographer. I'm not going to mention his name, Chris Ornade from Wall Street area, who's been coming up to the Bronx and shooting the prostitutes and drug addicts up there. You know, granted, we still have a problem with that. But he's like, you know, crossing that line and giving, paying the money and real graphic nudity and this, that, and the other. It's like, you're not helping anybody like that. You're enabling them. You know what I mean? And you go against the whole fabric of photojournalism and things of that. And it's like, you want to help some, you almost want to like protect our own community because somebody else is going to come and distort it or tell their own version. I belong to a collective of photographers called Los Seis del Sur, the six from the south. And it's six photographers from the Bronx who documented the Bronx during the 60s, 70s, and 80s who show the beauty. Devastation is part of it, but it's not only, it's not just the devastation.
Sure, that's not the whole story.
It's not the whole story. You know what I mean? And that's us protecting our beloved Bronx, so to speak, our beloved, you know, Hispanic Black community.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I just thought it was notable that your dad also felt that way about Latin
music. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. You know, my dad lived it. I mean, quick example. I'm up at Cornell University, 2008. Me, Afrika Bambaataa, Crazy Legs, Kaz, this, that, and the other. We go to it's a 4-day symposium on hip hop and the opening of the Cornell Hip Hop Archives up there, and you have these people speaking about the culture of hip hop. And again, I'm not going to mention any names, but Mark Anthony Neal, you know, all these, you know, so-called historians, is on stage in front of like 500 people talking about Grandmaster Caz. And Caz stands up and goes, "Why are you talking about me when I'm here and I could be talking about myself? I can tell my story because I lived it." And that is so important. I had a conversation with Curtis Blow last night. "Curtis, you need to do your book. You need to do your autobiography. You need to do something. Because God forbid something happens to you, somebody else is going to tell your story." And that's what it is. You know, the onus is on us, the so-called pioneer or whatever, to tell our story before it gets told by somebody else. And my dad, you know, his book is phenomenal, but it's told in a first-person type thing in a way where it's based on his experience.
Yeah.
It's not secondhand or anything like that. And that is so important.
Yeah. And so you know, speaking of documenting stuff, maybe 8 years ago or so, your photographs were used and you sort of oversaw a book called Born in the Bronx.
That is right. I was introduced to a gentleman by the name of Johan Kugelberg, who's came to the United States. He's a Swedish collector. Grandmaster Caz introduced me to him. And he was just collecting albums at the time. And one day he asked Caz, "Did anybody take pictures back then?" I got a phone call from Caz. I got an email from Johan thinking, you know, he'd like to buy some of my images. Brought over 3 or 4 dozen milk crates of negatives and pictures. He's like, "Oh my God, this is, you know, you're like the fly on the wall. These are, you know, lost treasures. They need to be in a book. They need to do this." I'm like, "Are you going to buy any images?"
No.
But
okay, see you later.
See you later. But being the man of his word that he is, an exhibition was put together, Born in the Bronx. It traveled all over the world. It's donated to Cornell Hip Hop. And the book, Born in the Bronx, has brought me all over the world. And we're still great friends today. We're working on my second book of my Latin images, an anniversary issue of Born in the Bronx, and he gets it. He gets it. You know what I mean? And it's been a phenomenal collaboration, you know, and shout out to Johan. And he's part of the culture, you know. He is.
He's done a ton of stuff with Cornell.
Other books on vintage T-shirts. He did a book on Buddy Esquire's coming out in the next couple of months. It's just phenomenal.
Yeah. And, you know, I wanted to jump back for a second to the hip-hop scene. So, you know, you meet the Cold Crush, you're shooting shows, there are these jams. Then in 79, there's a record and called Rapper's Delight. And this record becomes a hit. But even before it becomes a hit, it kind of comes out, people are hearing it. How did people around you react to that record when you first heard it? And then did that change
once it became a worldwide hit? We were happy. We were like, wow, you know, but it was almost comical because mm-hmm. these guys had no street cred or anything like that. And they were our equivalent to the Monkees, you know, us growing up seeing the Monkees put together that none of them could actually sing or play an instrument. This, that, and the other. And, you know, I'm not going to get into, like, you know, how they stole Kaz's lines.
This verse of Rapper's Delight was made up of lyrics that Big Bank Hank took from Grandmaster Kaz.
Check it out. I'm the C-A-S-N, the O-V-A, and the rest is F-L-Y. You see, I go by the code of the doctor of the mix. And these reasons, I'll tell you why. You see, I'm 6'1", and I'm tons of fun, and I dress to a D. You see, I got more clothes than Muhammad Ali, and I dress so viciously. I got bodyguards, I got...
The following is an excerpt of an article written by Grandmaster Kaz upon the death of Big Bank Hank in 2014 called Making Peace with Big Bank Hank. People are starting to run up on me in street and school. Yo, I heard your record on the radio. And I'm like, that's not me. What are you talking about? And they're like, Rapper's Delight. And I'm like, oh, nah, that's Hank. And everybody's like, huh? Hank? What's he doing on a record? Why ain't it you? Why is he playing your stuff? Yo, I know you're getting paid from that. And I'm like, no. My whole thing was, I moved on. I was in the end of my Casanova Fly days going into my Grandmaster Kaz era. I joined the Cold Crush Brothers after that, and we were still bent on trying to be who we are in the street. I never went to anybody and demanded, you owe me money, this is mine, or anything like that. Since they left the Sugar Hill Gang, Wonder Mike and Master G, we've become kind of cool, friends and compatriots. Mike and G said they didn't really know Hank was using my lyrics. They thought it was kind of strange he kept saying the same thing all the time, over and over. You know, the hip-hop community has known this for years. I'm not the first person whose lyrics got stolen and didn't get compensated, and unfortunately I probably won't be the last. Eventually, those guys realized that they weren't getting what they were supposed to get. Master G saw the crooked dealings at Sugar Hill, now run by Sylvia's son Joey Robinson, and left. Mike held out a little longer, and when things didn't change, Mike left as well.
It was life-changing, because that record played on every boombox, radio, speaker hanging out the window, this, that, and the other.
Did you see people around you kind of go from being like, oh, this is, you know... what is this? Why would you put it on a record? What is this nonsense? To kind of thinking like, oh, I've got to do this for myself.
Well, amongst ourselves, we laughed at it, you know, and we thought of it as a novelty, but it gave the groups, the guys, incentive to put something on wax. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, all these indie record labels were popping up and this, that, and the other, trying to achieve the same success as Sylvia and Sugar Hill Records and stuff. And that, for me, it changed. You know, 84, 85, you know, my camera was put down and, you know, things changed.
Yeah, and there's a bridge there. And actually, you have a picture, I think, that is emblematic of this. You have a shot of Run DMC opening for Cold Crush. And in a lot of ways, you know, I don't think they did it or meant to do it or anything, but Run DMC's success would kind of mark the end of that era. When you saw them perform, did you have any idea? Were you kind of like, this is something?
They had, you know, a hit record at the time, and it was the hit record, It's Like That.
Beat,
And but they didn't have the street cred or the popularity as the Cold Crush Brothers. So they were the opening up act for the Cold Crush Brothers. You know what I mean? Cold Crush Brothers didn't have a hit record at the time. I think Punk Rock Rap or Weekend was out or something like that. Out of the lane without further ado, let the ball run down this week for you. We're the Cold Crush Four, giving you more, and we just came to say, ooh, our relief it is, so when the weekend comes your way, so grab a chair from anywhere and listen while we speak, cause the Four's gonna start this record off with the first day of the week, Monday. The train was late in your heart. But they had the street cred, the popularity, this, that, and the other. So most people came to see the Cold Crush Brothers. Yeah. It's funny how the tides turn, how, you know, Run DMC would be one of the most popular hip-hop groups to date, you know, and Cold Crush not. But, you know, Run DMC, you speak to any one of them, Reverend Run, you know, and DMC, they looked up to the Cold Crush Brothers.
Of course, and that whole era, right? Run was the son of Curtis Blow.
Yeah, yeah.
When he started out. So there were plenty of venues for early hip hop shows, from, you know, gymnasiums, like you said, you know, churches, and the, you know, up all the way up to nightclubs.
And let's not forget the playgrounds, outdoor playgrounds.
Right, and the outdoor playgrounds. Also a Burger King. That was the oddest one.
Burger Kings. Just like the skating rings, independently owned, franchise, this, that, and the other. So you got, you know, friendly with one owner of one Burger King on Westchester Avenue and Third Avenue. And when Burger King would close at 9, 10 o'clock at night, it'd become the local jam center. Amazing, right?
Yeah.
But it's true. True. You can credit Lovebug Starkey's for starting that.
And there's this one live picture you took of a group, I guess you could call them a group, called Wayne and Charlie.
Wayne and Charlie. Wayne and Charlie, another act that doesn't get their just due. They were the first hip-hop ventriloquist act. True story. True. They would play venues like Harlem World and different venues. And, you know, Wayne, I forgot who was the dummy, whether it was Wayne or Charlie, but, you know, African-American with an African-American dummy doing ventriloquists in hip hop.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's one picture you have.
I have a whole
them
series. We just used that one.
Yeah. I had no idea something like that even existed. One or two kind of final things about it there before moving into kind of your relaunch, as it were. You have a bunch of pictures. I referenced this before.
Man, you went through my entire archive.
Yeah, well, of this boat ride, right, for Norman Thomas High School with the Treacherous Three.
Treacherous
and the Cold Crush.
Three, the Cold Crush Brothers, you know, high school back. Norman Thomas High School was the home base for the Treacherous Three at the time. I think Special K and L.A. Sunshine went there. I'm not sure.
It looked like one hell of a party, just to judge
by
the picture.
So they used to do these annual senior trip boat rides, okay, on the Circle Liner up to Bear Mountain.
Yeah.
And do these hip-hop parties, jams, on the boat all the way up to Bear Mountain, hang out at Bear Mountain, play basketball, go paddling, canoeing, and come back and play more music. So that was an annual event. I think we did three of them, if I remember correctly. But again, you know, these were our venues. These were our school buddies, our schoolmates, and this, that, and the other. And that's how, you know, word got out and this, that, and the other. And they were fun.
Yeah. And finally, you know, while flipping through your book, I saw a picture from, I think it was Harlem World in 81. And there's a very young Master Ace.
Oh, wow.
In the picture.
Yes. Yeah. With the Harlem World marquee in the background.
I think so. Yeah.
He passed away.
Okay.
Many, many, many years ago. But Master Ace is one of those other unsung heroes, a young Puerto Rican kid from, I think, the Patterson Projects or Clark Projects.
So it's not Master Ace, the guy, the rapper?
No.
Okay.
No.
I was confused. That's who I thought it was.
It's not, not that Master Ace. But this was a young Hispanic DJ that DJed for Kaz, DJed for a lot of the pioneers at the time.
Okay.
But no, not that Master
Ace. Not that Master Ace.
The younger Master Ace, who was not featured in this picture, will be coming up in 2 weeks on episode 120 of The Cypher.
That Master Ace, I don't, you know, I'm not sure how old he was, but I don't think he was born. It's like, I shot Maze the other day at Radio City Music Hall. You know, he sings about Harlem World, but he wasn't even born.
He adopted the Harlem World, you know, name from the club
Jay-Z,
he used to hang out at.
Yeah, I don't think he was even old enough. You know what I mean? So, right.
Yeah, Jay-Z would have been 8 or 9 at the time.
But I've been real quickly starting a rumor that Barry Obama, who was in Columbia University at the time, used to go to Harlem World and see the Cold Crush, who later became the president of the United States. So you never know.
Yeah, amazing. So, you know, around the time your grandmother passed, you know, you put down your camera. You had some problems.
I sold my cameras.
I guess, to be less euphemistic about it.
Yeah, well, I put it down as a deposit to get drugs.
Right, Well, what I wanted to ask about that is you've been very open about that. Were you aware at the time that your father had had a drug problem decades before?
No, I used to have nightmares of my father bringing me to shooting galleries and seeing him get high. You know, and at that time, my father and I used to get high together. You know, not, you know, cocaine, you know, liquor and this, that, and the other. But my father had, you know, was part of the Rockefeller era where methadone was first introduced and got off of heroin through methadone at that time, but continued with other substances. And, you know, drugs and alcohol for me was just a social thing growing up. Part of the music business, part of the scene growing up. And it's not until I experienced death for the first time in my life, the passing of my grandmother, who was so instrumental in my life, it's when I turned to drugs to hide from that pain. And I essentially, it was a downward spiral after that. Lost my job, became homeless, living in the streets, this, that, and the other, you know, and sold all my camera equipment and got arrested for the first time in my life. And it wasn't until I spent, you know, 24 hours in central booking, I was like, whoa, this is not for me. So all these felony charges that were, you know, imposed on me were later dropped because I completed a drug program, an 18-month drug program. And, you know, you probably heard me say I just celebrated 24 years of being clean and sober.
Yeah, congratulations.
You know? Thank you.
Yeah.
And, you know, but my trials and tribulations made me the man who I am today. So I have no problem sharing that. You know what I mean? And it's just like I picked up the camera again when I got sober in the early 90s. Started my career with the fire department and, you know, been taking pictures ever since then. Again.
Yeah. And, you know, your reentry into photography in some ways, you know, corresponded with your negatives coming back. And the story around that is so wild that you know, your mother and your friends saved them because it was a connection to you.
Yes,
and you were essentially
my mother
lost.
Tells the stories like, you know, again, you know, the addiction is a disease, okay? So, you know, when my mother was dealing with my substance abuse, my addiction to drugs, it, you know, she's like, you're not my son. You're an addict. You know what I mean? And she, you know, by the grace of God, she's the one that threw me out into the street. And I thank her to today for doing that. In the middle of the winter, thrown out in the street. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? I'm your son. She goes, you're not my son. You're an addict. And I thank her for that today, because if it wasn't hitting rock bottom for me, I probably wouldn't be here talking to you. But, you know, she had the foresight or just the family instincts to hold on to whatever she could. And those were my negatives. Easy AD had the foresight just to hold on to this, you know, while I was going through my addiction. And it wasn't until, you know, fast forward years later, I got a call from Henry Chalfant, who was doing Mambo to Hip Hop and wanted to license one of my images. And I'm like, huh? License? Use? Yeah. I'll give you $100. No problem. Mom, you still have that shoebox of negatives? AD, you still have those, you know, binders of negatives? Yeah. And that's when it started. I got all my negatives together and just, you know, 10,000 plus. And started scanning, reteaching myself photography because the digital age had come about.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I wasn't familiar with it. And been on a journey since.
Sure. And, you know, it's interesting that that was for a documentary because, you know, of course, you had been involved in movies before in a not exactly documentary.
Right.
Called Wild Style.
Yeah. I was just telling the story last night. If you watch the movie today on DVD, Wild Style is the scene of the Cold Crush Brothers and the Fantastic at the Dixie Club. Which was an after hours joint. You'll see a flash going off in the background.
And that's you?
And that's me. And they'll pan up and I'm standing up on the bar taking pictures.
Wow.
Yeah. And I told Charlie Ahern, I said, listen, you know, I got no photo credit. You didn't put me in the cast or anything like that. So it's like, but I'm actually in the movie, yeah.
You have a shot of the Cold Crush signing the contract to be in the movie.
Yes.
With Charlie. What on earth was it like to have your friends be like, I'm going to be in a movie?
Well, it was phenomenal. A new era, a new groundbreaking stuff. You know, yeah. Here's Charlie Ahern, you know, who had the foresight to do this movie called Wild Style. It's come up to the Bronx with Fat Five Freddy, you know, and shooting the Cold Crush and everybody else, Pebbly, you know, all those, you know, Lisa Lee and all that, and actually put a contract in their hands. Wasn't much. I think they got 1% of 1% divided by six.
However many of them there were.
However,
yeah.
But they, you know, listen, they still get their checks today.
Yeah.
And, you know, however small or large it is, but they still get a check. You know what I mean? And it was just a defining moment. And I just took pictures of them signing the contract.
Crazy. You know, jumping back to something a little more contemporary. You know, you've talked about your 9/11 story in other interviews, you know, in some detail,
right.
How you were kind of buried alive for, you know, in rubble from a nearby hotel and got out and shuttled people to safety. Very, very dramatic story. Rather than asking you to recount that, what I'm curious about is how going through that changed you, both in bad ways and maybe in positive ways.
I live a very simple life today. A, because of being homeless and my drug addiction and being a practitioner of the 12 steps. You know what I mean? And it has gotten me to a point where, you know, I try and keep things simple. You know, as we say in recovery, keep it simple, stupid. You know what I mean? That's it. 9/11 came along. I'm an adrenaline junkie at that time, working for EMS, FDNY EMS. You know, being a paramedic EMT on an ambulance, you have to be an adrenaline junkie. And real briefly, you know, the call came over, airplane in the building. Partner and I looked at each other. It's like, this is what we've been waiting for. We wait for those shootings, stabbings, car accidents, just any other. You know what I mean? And, you know, we go down there. My ambulance is one of the first ambulances from the Bronx to arrive there. And real quickly, fucking building falls. None of us had any idea. We parked our ambulances and fire trucks at the base of the buildings. We didn't think these buildings would collapse. But it was such a profound moment for me because after, you know, being buried alive and getting out and doing 2 years of therapy behind it, because I had what's called survivor's guilt. And, you know, literally, if you ran left that day, you lived. And if you ran right, you died. And, you know, dozens of my friends were killed that day. But more so, what I got out of therapy was it wasn't my time to go. I still had a lot more to share with the world. And it was just like, boom. Henry Chalfant calls. Mom, you got my negatives. Joe, we're sending you to whatever to represent the fire department for, you know, 9/11. And it's just like, that's how I just live my life. Everything, there's a reason for everything, okay? We have a saying in Spanish, no hay mal que por bien no venga. There isn't any bad that happens that good does not come out of. And you have to find that good. So.
And, you know, you mentioned representing the fire department in 9/11. I know you have been active politically in terms of, like, health issues around first responders.
True. True. I was instrumental in part of that group of first responders that got the 9/11 health bill enacted. I went to Washington a half dozen times, met with the president's people and Congress and this, that, and the other. You know, we got that bill enacted, workman comps bill passed, and, you know, still continue to fight for the Drazoga bill and this, that, and the other. But, you know, I got off the ambulance. I got involved in labor, became a union delegate. I became the vice president of my union. I represent 4,000 EMTs and paramedics, largest union of EMTs and paramedics in the country. And we fight like my grandmother did for the people of the Bronx. I continued that, but for the service members that I represent who save lives every day in the city of New York.
And part of that, naturally, after something like 9/11,
yes.
was the health.
Yeah, because health my bills. Members are still passing away because of 9/11.
Right. Wasn't there, there was one particular one, I think, in 06.
There's been a few. Yeah. I mean, there's been a few. I'm not going to name them, but, you know, weird cancers popping up, weird respiratory diseases and this, that. And we knew this was going to happen. We knew this, and we're still seeing it to today. So that's why the Drazoga bill is so important. You know, I can't fathom why they approve bills like that for like clips of 5 years, 10 years, when they just approve it forever.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because it's continued. You know, whether it's PD, fireman, an EMT, a paramedic, whatever. You know, people developing signs and symptoms of illnesses related to 9/11.
And, I mean, I know people who were, you know, all the way up to the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
Who
even the civilians that lived there. You know, and thank God, knock on wood, I physically haven't, you know, got anything yet, but I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Sure.
I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Yeah. You know, I got a nice little certificate framed in my house saying Joe suffers from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So I show that to my wife every once in a while. I said, don't mess with me. This is my get out of jail free card here. But, you know, in all seriousness, you know, I love what I do as a union laborer, representing, you know, the men and women that so diligently, you know, help other people in the city, and my photography.
Yeah. Excellent. And so, you know, before we get to what you're up to now, one final picture I have to ask about. There is, it's in your archives, there's a fantastic picture of a 76 Chevy Malibu.
Ooh, was that
your car?
That was my car. It was one of the first cars I ever owned. I bought it down in South Carolina because I was in the Army at the time. Right at the height of my drug addiction, I got a yelling from my dad and mom's, and basically my dad said, if you don't join the Army, I'm gonna put you in St. Raymond's. And I'm like, what the fuck is St. Raymond's? He goes, I'm gonna put you in St. Raymond's Cemetery because I gave you life and I'll take it away from you. So I joined the Army, ran away from my drug issues at the time, but I learned about alcohol in the Army. But anyway, I bought my nice, beautiful 76 Chevy Malibu with 60-inch, you know, tires in the back, and used to drive it from New York and South Carolina, and I love it. Great car.
What happened to it?
I think I got so many tickets that they towed it away and lost it. But, you know, listen, cars back then, pop the hood, change a cable, change this, it's running again. You know what I mean? Today's cars, it's computer this, computer that, and I just loved it. That was my favorite car.
And so so what are you up to now? We talked off air a little bit about where you were yesterday.
I wear a lot of hats today. I recently, like we were talking about earlier, I got hired to be a set photographer for the new Netflix TV series called The Get Down, directed by Baz Luhrmann, who's known for his spectacular movies like The Great Gatsby and Moulin Rouge and all those other stuff. And it was kind of crazy, like when we first read in the Daily Sheets or whatever, that this flamboyant director would be doing something on, you know, the birth of hip hop or the time period of hip hop.
Right. What does this Australian guy know?
What does this Australian guy know about hip hop? You know, so again, the usual backlash comes, like, why is he telling our story, this, that, and the other? But to give him some credit, you know, he reached out to pioneers like Flash and Curtis Blow and Lady Pink from the Graffiti and, you know, other people like Nelson George to help direct this and put this together. I found out from him that he uses my Born in the Bronx book and my archives as reference pieces for the actors and stuff and for the show. And that's a humbling thing to be told. You know, I ran into him a couple of weeks ago. He's like, Joe, I'm going to do this school scene at South Bronx High School, and I'm going to put a kid with an afro with a camera and walking around taking pictures. And, you know, he's not going to be called Joey Kane, but you can be rest assured that that's Joey Kane in the series.
Wow.
And that's
unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then I get an email day before yesterday, Baz wants you on the set as a set photographer. We're going to pay you union scale fees and this, that, and the other. Come shoot. And, you know, so I go from the Tools of War Park Jams in Crotona Park that I've been documenting for the last 13 years, run out to the studios out in Queens, and I'm shooting Jaden Smith, Will Smith's son, who's one of the main actors. I'm shooting, you know, all these B-boys that I shoot out in the street who've got parts as extras and dancers. So it was like, you know, amazing. Amazing. So, yeah, I'm doing that. I'm shooting all the Park Jams hip hop, you know, series going on. I shoot for Summer Stage, Central Park Summer Stage. I shoot a lot of their events and fighting the fight.
All right. Well, that sounds like a great note to end on. Yeah. Joe Conzo, thank you so much for coming through.
Thank you for having me. Yeah. And if you're out there, please go check out the exhibition at the Museum of City
of
New York.
Of course. Oh, my goodness.
Called Hip Hop Revolution. Real quickly, I got to share this with you.
Please.
2015 has just been a spectacular year. I've got 5 major exhibitions going on. I don't think any other photographer can say that. I mean, I have a show at the Museum of City in New York going on in September with fantastic photographers Jeanette Beckman and Martha Cooper.
Also a guest on the show,
yes,
Jeanette.
Yeah. Who I love both, and their archives are phenomenal. I just had a show come down at the Bronx Museum called 3 Photographers. Was a phenomenal show. It was a time period piece where the 2 other photographers shot the Bronx, 40s, 50s, 50s, 60s, and myself, 70s, 80s. That just came down last week. I have a show at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum in Cleveland, Ohio. I mean, Elvis Presley, Joe Conzo. How fucking cool is that? I just came back from Paris. I'm part of a collective show out in Paris, you know. I got a show in Cuba.
Oh.
In Cuba on my Latin images. I'm flying out to Amsterdam in September to do a show out there. So it's just, I'm blessed. I'm really, really blessed. And it's just, you know, I just needed to plug all those things. So,
of course. I mean, we've you know, had Jeanette on talking about the museum, you know, the show at MCNY.
Yeah, I love Jeanette. JB, she's cool.
It's a phenomenal show. And I guess just before you go, like, do you feel like there aren't that many people who were, you know, like you and Martha and Jeanette taking pictures in the 70s and 80s? You kind of predate Jeanette by a little bit.
Listen, the way I tell it is there was only a handful of us taking pictures back then. I mean, listen, there's plenty of images that predate my images and Martha's images and JB's images because, you know, people walked around with the little Instamatic 110 cameras or the Kodak 126 cameras, this, that, and the other. But we were photographers. We shot, went home, developed this, that, and the other. And I love the fraternity that we're in because there's only a handful of us. Throw Jamal Shabazz in there, throw Ernie Panicoli in there, you know, and a few others. There was only a handful of us, you know. What separates me from them is that I came from within the culture. I was one of those little blacks and Latinos taking pictures, you know, unlike, you know, other people coming from downtown to take pictures, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Or coming, you know, from another, you know, country and stuff. But we love each other. We support each other. Martha and I, and, you know, I'm going to say it first and she'll probably get mad, but Martha and I got invited to do a group show in Cuba next year, you know, and we're so excited about that. You know what I mean? Jeanette and I do panels all the time. You know what I mean? So, you know, we're the gatekeepers of the warehouse, so to speak, of early images of this culture. You know, JB shot punk for many years. She's the gatekeeper of that. Marty's New York images before the hip hop are just phenomenal. You know, I wanted to be Martha Cooper, so to speak, because I wanted to make a living on photography. I couldn't. I didn't. I went, got a career, but now I, you know, sometimes I make more money with my photography than my city job. But we're all such good friends because we've known each other for so many years, for so many years. And like when somebody comes to me for an image and I don't have it, I'm like, call Martha Cooper. Here's her stuff. Call Jeanette Beckman and vice versa.
Yeah.
Martha would go, Joe, I just gave your email to so-and-so because I don't have, you know, that Cold Crush or that Cool Herc or Bambaataa image. And that's how much we love and we respect each other.
Thanks again.
No, thank you. Thank you. This was fun.
Hip-hop's early years, basically from its creation in the early 1970s until Run-DMC became the genre's first superstars a decade later, are overlooked by many, mostly because it was primarily a live art form for much of that time. There were no records at all for the first 6 or so years, and many of the early ones didn't capture the power of the live event. That's the reason Joe Kanzo's photos are so crucial. They provide some of the best documentation of the early years of a great American art form. What the groups wore on stage and off, what venues they were playing, what the audiences looked like, Joe's photos capture it all. As if that wasn't enough, he gave us a real portrait of an often mythologized place and time, the Bronx of the 1970s. And in his spare time, he also managed to capture the entire Latin music revival. Joe is, as you heard, still active today. Since this interview was recorded, I've seen him, camera in hand, at numerous park jams and concerts. If you're in New York City, please get to the Museum of the City of New York by September 15th to see photos by Joe, former Cypher guest Jeanette Beckman, and Martha Cooper in the exhibit Hip Hop Revolutions. And if you're not, check out thecyphershow.com for links to Joe's whole archive at Cornell University. We're back to our weekly schedule, so join us next week for a conversation with Danan Porter. Danan is best known as a member of the group D12, a group that also features one of his best friends, some guy named Eminem. He is also a producer who has helmed hits for M, 50 Cent and G-Unit, Busta Rhymes, Exhibit, and tons more. We talk about learning to produce from Dilla and Dre, his time in D12, and his brand new solo EP, Stuff in My Backpack. As I mentioned earlier, make sure you subscribe to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, a rating or a review will really help us out. If you want to go even further to support the show, visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and make a donation. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us basically anywhere on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this week's episode, ideas you have for future guests, anything you'd want to know. You can find more information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sitaro.
He goes, I'm going to put you in St. Raymond Cemetery because I gave you life and I'll take it away from you.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
He uses my Born in the Bronx book and my archives as reference pieces and for the show.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
He worked at United Bronx Parents also.
Special thanks to our number one Patreon supporter, Vikram.
Sold all my camera equipment and got arrested for the first time in my life.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
A bit fat, but the way Cass tells the story is that, like, the blackout the next day, there was, you know, 50 more DJs out there.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's basically what I heard.
Basically, you know what I mean? But, you know,
it's a good story. It's maybe too good of a story,
but he's consistent and he says it all the time.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, he might have noticed that, you know, Cass and you know, those handful of people at that time might have been, you know, in that part of the Bronx, or whatever, the only people DJing at the time. And, you know, a week later after Blackout, here comes, you know, so-and-so with his set of equipment. You know what I mean? And Kaz's like, yeah. Where the fuck you get that out? Remember the Blackout? So, you know, there might be some truth to it, but, you know, I know it's embellished a little bit.
Sure. Like I was
but he's consistent. He says it, and it's a phenomenal story.